ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 84, the sages' teaching at Kurukshetra. This is the summary. This chapter describes the arrival of great sages at Kurukshetra to observe the auspicious occasion of the solar eclipse, the sages' glorification of Lord Krishna, and Vasudeva's enthusiastic performance of sacrifices. On the occasion of the solar eclipse at Kurukshetra, exalted ladies like Kunti, Draupadi, and Subhadra got some chance to associate with Lord Krishna's queens. Seeing how much the Lord's consorts loved their husbands, the ladies were struck with wonder. As the women talked among themselves and the men did likewise, great sages headed by Narada and Vyasa arrived there, desiring to see Lord Krishna. The various kings and other leading personalities who were sitting at their leisure, including the Pandavas, Krishna, and Balaram, stood up as soon as they saw the sages. The leaders all bowed down to the great soul, inquired about their well-being, and worshipped them by offering them sitting places, water, and so on. Lord Krishna then said, "Now our lives are successful, for we have obtained the goal of life, the audience of great sages and yoga masters, which even demigods only rarely attain. The water at a holy place of pilgrimage and the deity forms of the gods can purify one only after a long time. But saintly persons purify just by being seen. Those who identify themselves with their bodies and neglect to honor transcendental sages like you are no better than ashes." It's always interesting how the devotees want to see Krishna and Krishna wants to see the devotees. After hearing Lord Krishna speak these words in the mood of a mere mortal, the sages remained silent for a long time, bewildered. Then they said, "How amazing our Lord is. He covers his true identity with human-like activities and pretends to be subject to superior control. Surely he has spoken in this way only to enlighten the general populace. Such behavior of his is indeed inconceivable." The sages continued to glorify the Lord as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supersoul, and the friend and worshiper of the Brahmins. Glorifying each other. After the sages had praised him, Lord Krishna offered them his obeisances, and they begged his permission to return to their hermitages. But just then, Vasudeva came forward, bowed to the sages, and asked, "What activities can one perform to be freed from the bondage of fruitive work?" The sages replied, "By worshipping the Supreme Lord Hari through the performance of Vedic sacrifices, you will become free from the bondage of fruitive work." What's our Vedic sacrifice that we're doing? Vasudeva then, so he asked them what to do. They told him, do sacrifices to please the Lord. So naturally, what is he then going to say? Okay, let's do it. So Vasudeva then requested the sages to act as his priests, and he arranged for Vedic sacrifices to be performed with super excellent paraphernalia. Afterward, Vasudeva presented the priests with valuable gifts of cows and jewelry, and also with marriageable Brahmin girls. So that's an interesting point. Because sometimes people say, and someone says in the Shastra also, that women are all suitors. So how come it says here Brahmin girls? What does this mean? Born in a Brahmin family. Is that what makes you a Brahmin? Is that what Krishna says? What does Krishna say? What's the verse? Chatur, Vanyam, Mayashitam. What are the next words? Guna, Karma, Vibhakasha. And then there's a verse after that that says for women it's Janma, right? Is that correct? Krishna says it's Guna and Karma for men, and the next verse he says it's Janma for women. Is that true or not? Is it true or not?
No.
Okay. So how do you get a Brahmin girl? What's the problem with her?
What are the qualities of Brahma?
Yeah. Now, only qualities? Does Krishna say, just guna vibhavishaha? He says what? Guna karma. Good karma. How did they determine who was a Brahmin girl? Do you know? How did you determine who was a Brahmin? Someone what?
Someone,
yes, okay. The Brahmin qualities Krishna mentions in the 18th chapter. What was it? Just like yesterday, there was one Indian gentleman who's just new to Krishna consciousness, and he says that his parents want to arrange his marriage, and he wants to marry a girl who will help him in Krishna consciousness, but his parents are very concerned that she's from the same caste. Now, of course, they're probably thinking in terms of birth. So what family from? He said, Brahmin family. So then he said, my father says that something is very important. What is that something besides caste? What do you think that something is? And if that's not right, don't do the marriage. What do you think is that something? That's a given. They don't even say that.
Horoscope.
Horoscope. So there's a verb where Prabhupada says, at least one, where he says that you do the horoscopes to determine whether or not the boy and girl are of the same. What are we talking about here? Are the same caste, or the same varna? So if it was varna by birth, would you have to do a horoscope to determine the varna? What would you just look at then? The family. And Prabhupada says very specifically, you look at the horoscope to see that the boy and girl are of the same varna. So does that mean that a boy and girl could be of different varnas than their parents? Okay. So what does this tell us about women? That women have? They have varna, don't they? Do they or not?
Yeah.
Is that clear? Can someone think of some other instances of where it's very, very clear that they are Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra women?
I noticed this in there that Kshatriyas can't marry a Brahmin woman.
Yes, that there's Pratilom and Anulom marriages. And which one is okay?
Someone from the same caste as well.
You're talking from the man's point of view. You're assuming the man's point of view there. You made an assumption. So explain it from a neutral point of view. What kind of mixed marriage is okay? If the man is higher, the man is higher. And what marriage is not okay? If the woman is higher. Any idea why that might be? Okay, and what would happen to a higher class woman with a lower class man? She'd become? She'd become lower class. Obviously they didn't like that idea, did they? They didn't want the women to become degraded. They didn't want the woman, or even if she didn't become lower class, she'd be forced to act according to a lower class standard. They didn't want that to happen. Now, does it always happen that if a higher class man marries a lower class woman, that he elevates her? Does that always happen?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Can you give me an example? There's a Shastric example.
Jamila?
Yeah, a Jamila. So a Jamila, because sometimes when Prabhupada was asked, how does a woman become a Brahmana? He just says if she's married to a Brahmin man, she's considered a Brahmin. He'd sometimes just give a very simple answer. But the fact is, if she's a Brahmana, she gets married to a Brahmin man. It's not that marrying to a Brahmin man makes her Brahmin. It's because she's a Brahmana, she should get married to a Brahmin man. Think of the Jamila. Was he married to a Brahmin lady? Yes, he was married to a Brahmin lady. And then, can a Brahmana have more than one wife? Is that permissible? Yes. Okay. So, then, who did he take on as his wife? Okay? A what she called in the Bhagavatam specifically, she's called that? Sudrani. Sudrani. Did she become a Brahmani?
No.
What happened?
He became
less than Sudrani. Right? She degraded him. So are women just like sort of blobs and they just become whoever they marry? Did that happen?
No.
If you marry any woman to a Brahmin man, does she become a Brahmin? No. Otherwise, would that story make any sense? It would have no meaning. As soon as he married this other girl, then she would become also Brahmin. But she didn't, did she? Now she could have. Like Devahuti, when she married Kardama Muni, she was a Kshatriya. She took on the qualities of a Brahmin. But still, when she wanted children, he arranged everything more like Kshatriya, didn't he? Palaces and maidservants and all that kind of stuff. Wanted to take care of her nature. When Prabhupada gives the example of Kshatriya mentality, what is the mentality of Kshatriya? Do you know what example he gives?
Goodness.
For Kshatriya? He gives an example. He gives a specific example of a specific person. Do you know what example that is? No? Of a woman. He gives the example of a woman. I forget her name. He said it was a historical example that this one queen's husband had gone off to battle, and the guard told her, "Your husband is now at the door. He's returned from the battle." And she says, "Oh, get ready for the victory celebration." They says, "No, my queen, he lost." And she said, "Well, do you have all the medics ready? He must be severely wounded." "No, my queen, he's in perfectly good health." She said, "Then he's an imposter. Don't let him in." She said, "My husband is either wins, dead, or severely wounded. Those are the only choices. There's no defeated in good health choice." Said, "So it's not him." So they sent the message down, "Sorry. You're not the king. The queen's only going to let in her husband, not somebody else." Then he went back to the battlefield and he won. So probably gives that as an example of such a mentality. So this tells us that women don't only have ashrama. Sometimes people say that women only have ashrama, that their only duties are ashram duties, that they don't have any varna duties. Would that make any sense? If somebody has a nature, an activity, guna karma, then wouldn't it be reasonable that they do some karma? Of course, there's some activities according to that guna. And what happens when you don't allow that? What do you think happens? If you say women only have ashram duties, they have no varna duties. What do you think happens? They'll follow it anyway, won't they? Right. And what will you have in society? People who are very? What? Confused and? Right. We all have propensities. Suppose you're in a situation where you're not allowed. Very frustrated. So, of course, before the Industrial Revolution, naturally women, not only women, children, used to contribute to the economic well-being of the family. Is that correct? Before the Industrial Revolution, were women only cooking and cleaning and feeding the babies? What kind of things were they doing to contribute to the family's economic well-being?
Teaching
the children. They were often teaching children. What else were they doing? Yeah, they were helping with if they were Vaishyas, they were helping with the animals, with the farming, with preserving the food.
Brahmins had to worry about the sacrifice.
You had to have your wife with you for the sacrifice, didn't you? You weren't allowed, that's why Ramachandra had to make a golden deity statement. You weren't allowed to do the sacrifices without your wife. Like Advaitacharya and his wife were working together and worshipping their deity. Right, the Brahmins they study, they teach, they worship the deity, teach others to worship the deity, they accept charity, they give in charity. We find some Brahmin women listed as teachers in Bhagavatam. There are two women listed as impersonal teachers. But whatever Dasa was doing, they were assisting. What about the Kshatriya ladies? What was Draupadi doing? Do you know what Draupadi was doing? She looked after the entire house, but how many people was that? Do you remember? No. 100,000 people. She looked after the whole royal enclave, which was 100,000 people. It's like a small town. She was like the mayor of a small town. What else did she do? What else did she do? She ran the treasury. She told Satyabhama, she said, I'm the only one who knows the income and expenditure of the kingdom, and I manage the money. She was the secretary of the treasury. So we were reading before that when Lakshmana married Krishna, when she garlanded him, there were male and female dancers and musicians. So, depending on the varna, the women had occupations as sudras. Are there female servants? How many times do we meet as female servants? There's female entertainers. There are women who are helping with farming and cow protection if they're vaishyas. There are women who are helping run the kingdom if they're kshatriyas. And then there are women helping in deity worship and teaching and study if they're brahmanas. Does that make some sense? Then what happened in the Industrial Revolution? What happened?
Decided to go to work in factories?
Well, yeah. But not only you see before that, like Prabhupada quotes Chanika Pandit, saying that a man is happy if he doesn't have to leave home to go to work. Formerly, men didn't go off to a job, did they? They didn't go off to a job. Just like you even see today, there's a lot of business people. They have their shop on the ground floor and their residence on the top floor. You see this in the city still? You see this in New York, at least in the lower part of Manhattan and things like that. The shops downstairs and the homes upstairs and the homes in the back. Right? I was visiting many years ago some life members in Delhi, or I should say Delhi. I was six brothers, and four of them worked in the business. The father had died, and the mother was managing all the elderly woman. She was managing all the finances. If they wanted any money for the business, they have to ask her. She didn't go into the shop, but she was managing everything. She was one of the managers of the business. Is that pretty common? We call mom pa shop, right? And the children are also helping. Yesterday we went and got some nice hair from Didi. Did you see Monita's hair? Mm-hmm. Down over there. We got them some nice hair. So it was, the man was running the shop, his daughter was there, his grandson was there. This is typical, right? And then Industrial Revolution, the men had to go out to work. And one of the main ways that women got involved in the factories was with textiles, because the women used to make their own cloth at home. Or at least they would spin, all the women would spin. And there might be only, you know, a couple weavers in the town. Not necessarily every woman would weave. But at least all the women would spin. So that was taken out of the home. That was a big way women contributed to the economic well-being of their family. You know, now you want to buy a dress, one dress is $100. So imagine. And then so the women, in order to then make an economic contribution to the family and the society, they also had to go out of the home. And then the children, in order to make an economic contribution to the family, they also had to go out of the home. And everybody's working in these factories. And that's why we now have compulsory education. Where did compulsory education come from?
From the women.
Excuse me? Yeah, child labor. Because the children were working in these factories. Previously, the children had helped with the family. Right? They were Brahmin boys, they were helping with study, and they were helping also with the yajna. They were contributing to the family, and now the only way to contribute to the family was to go to a factory. And of course the children were getting injured in the factory, they were getting bad health, they were going deaf, they weren't getting any sunshine, they weren't getting proper nutrition. And so there was a push in the Western countries of the world for compulsory education. Which has not been a very good thing for a lot of people. There's many people that really don't want to be in school. And what do they do in school? Cause trouble. They don't want to be there. They're not inclined. You know, after they get their basic education, even that sometimes they're not inclined, but after they get their basic education, they don't want to sit in school. They're not academic. They want to do something. And because they're not getting anything practical to do, they do rubbish. So, you know, then they're saying, well, the men are thinking, the high-class men are thinking, I don't want my wife to go out of the home to work. I don't want my wife to work in a factory somewhere, office somewhere. I'll keep my wife at home. So then you had this society that existed like in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, where the men were working and the women were staying home. The children were in school. And what were the women doing at home? What are they doing? What did they have to do?
Clean.
How many, how often, how much can you clean? And then you have all these machines to clean. You know? How much work is there to do? Is there a whole day's worth of work to do? No. So, you know, they profound birth control so that we were only having 2-3 children. Used to be the average was 6. So they're only having 2-3 children. And they can buy, of course, canned food, frozen food. And they have their vacuum cleaner. What are they going to do? And one day the woman said, you know, we've just become sex objects. We don't have any, we're not doing anything meaningful in society anymore. Everybody wants to do something meaningful, isn't it? Don't you want to do something meaningful? They said, all right, we'll go out into the Ugra Karma workplace with the men. And this has caused this havoc in society. Untended children, adultery, something wrong. Even the women's liberation say that this has not been very, hasn't worked out very well. So this can only be done if we have a basic, simple society. We do. Even in modern industrial society, we have many families where husband and wife have their own business. They're working together in the business, or if they don't get along that well, they're working in different aspects of the business. And the children are also helping with the business. And then the children, that's one of the main ways that the children will grow up and feel part of a community. It's one of the secrets to having children grow up and feeling part of a community. You make them really part of the family and community from a young age. They're actually doing valuable work. Not just when you go to school and when you're 24 you can start doing valuable work. Okay, so why is it that women are also sometimes classified as shudras? Funny, I wasn't going to talk about this at all. I hadn't even looked at the summary. I had something else completely planned for this. Right. So why are women all classified as shudras? No. Can I have a Brahma Kshatriya Vaishya Shudra householder? Good guess. Well, everybody's serving. That's everyone who's servant, except for Krishna. And even Krishna likes to serve as devotees. Ekala Ishwara Krishna. Everybody else is a vritya. No, it's a fact. But that we could talk about another time. How that's what is there about, what do Brahmin, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas have in common?
Sacred place.
Mm-hmm. But they're all what?
Leaders.
And women are also educated. Getting close with the leaders. They're all independent. They all have some independence. Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya doesn't have a boss. And women by nature want to be dependent. By nature, a woman wants to have a boss. By nature. Therefore classified as shudras. So even though the women here are Brahmanas, explain the women are Brahmanas, still they're a little different kind of Brahmanas than the men. So a little different category. Not exactly the same. So similar but a little different. And by the way, understanding that women have varna does solve a lot of, not entirely, but we didn't have time to get into that. But it does solve a lot of the problem as to say that women are less intelligent or women are more lusty. Because do you think that that is comparing a Brahmana woman to a Shudra man? What do you think the comparison is between? A Brahmin woman to a Brahmin man? A Brahmin woman, otherwise you wouldn't be a Brahmin. A Brahmin woman must be more intelligent and less lusty than a Shudra man. Must be. Otherwise, how should she be a Brahmana? So it's comparing within varna. So that answers part of the question, at least. Does this comport with our everyday experience? Do we see that women also have different natures and tendencies, just like men do? Don't we see that? Isn't that practical experience? Are all women of the same nature? All right. So, afterwards, Vasudeva presented the priest with valuable gifts of cowls and jewelry, and also with marriageable Brahmana girls. So again, that wasn't my intention. Was that interesting?
Yeah.
Okay. Was that worth a little sidetrack to talk about that?
Yeah.
Yes.
What used to say to that show yesterday when not wanting to have four wives and cows?
What used to they have? Oh, they didn't give them to Narayani. That's a good question. When it says Vasudeva presented the priest with valuable gifts of cows and jewelry and also with marriageable Brahmin girls, that wasn't for everybody. It's not indiscriminate. Indiscriminate charity wouldn't be in the Lord of Goodness. And please don't ask me, but I was recently in some place where somebody gave me something very strange in charity. I was just telling my daughter about it. She and I were laughing. So, you know, she said, Michael, what are you going to do with that? I said, I have no idea. I think what I'm going to do with this thing. So, you know, charity should be given appropriately. Give somebody in charity something that they're going to use. You know, try to think who I'm going to give this thing to. So it should be given intelligently. You know, you don't want some gift that's completely inappropriate for you, would you? So I'm sure that Vasudeva had the intelligence to give gifts appropriately, according to the person's need and position. Of course, one thing that a Brahmin does, a Brahmin is supposed to accept charity and also give charity. And we see this is true in all the religious institutions of the world. There used to be not so much direct government expenditure on welfare. Who used to distribute most of the welfare in society? The churches. So the people in general would give charity to the religious institutions of the Brahmanas. The Brahmanas are supposed to be the only ones who can receive charity. And the government would also give to the Brahmanas, and part of one of the Brahmanas' occupational duties is to distribute charity. So they take the charity that they're given, they use it to worship the Lord. Not just you show the deity and you keep the deity in rags and you use the deity as an excuse to collect money and then you pocket it. So Brahmanas get charity, they can take what they need for their maintenance, and they use the rest to worship the Lord. The Brahmin is not trying to get, you know, $1 million in the bank. All those different instructions. Sometimes Prabhupada says a Brahmin just keeps what they need from that day, and sometimes he says that householder especially can keep something for emergencies. And then the Brahmin also distributes as need within the society. You see in Tirupati, there's the whole community there, and people are giving money to the deities. Who here has been to Tirupati? Just a few of you. So there's this big bag of money. Right? Big, big bag of money. And you just can't help giving a lot of money. And then you see behind the glass wall, there's 15 people counting the money. So you can see no one's cheating. And there's an armored truck there taking the money to the bank several times a day. And they're taking care of the whole community. There's schools, there's hospitals, everything. The temple is maintaining that. The temple is giving in charity. So that's part of the function of a Brahmana. And the Brahmana has some discrimination as to whom to give charity. The government can't quite figure this out, can they? No, when they're giving directly, they're actually causing more problems with their welfare than they solve. We call it unintended consequences. He then performed the ritual bath marking the end of the sacrifice and fed everyone sumptuously, even the village dogs. Next, he gave ample gifts to his relatives, the various kings and others, who all took Krishna's leave and returned to their own homes. Unable to depart because of his intense affection for his relatives, Nanda Maharaja remained at Kurukshetra for 3 months, served with reverence by the Yadavas. On one occasion, Vasudeva began to describe the deep friendship Nanda had shown him, shedding tears openly. At the end of 3 months, Nanda left for Mathura with the fond farewells of all the Yadavas. When the Yadavas finally saw that the rainy season was about to begin, they returned to Dwarka, where they related all that had happened at Kurukshetra to the residents of their capital. So I think instead of going on to the verse, we'll just stop here and see if there's any questions or comments or discussions. Otherwise, by the time we go on to the verse, that will be okay. Yeah. Is that all right? Is that okay? So any discussion or comments or questions on these points? Yes.
When they were talking about Devaki, she was the most selfless woman and serving her husband so nicely. She was initiated completely, being initiated. And then the Kadmumani was so happy and he blessed her with all the facilities and big brain and all
this. Yes, yes. And it's just like that. One does very. She did so much. Devahuti did so much selfless service for Kardama Muni that she forgot even about her own bodily necessities, because that was his mood. That was his mood. He was just, you know, he was a yogi. So she also took on his mentality. But it's described when they got married that they were of the same nature. The reason they married. The Swayambhu Manu could see that his daughter Devahuti actually had that nature. Yes?
In relation to the chanting practice,
So, you're asking a question from yesterday. So most of you weren't there yesterday. You were at the students' program, and we were talking about that the best way to advance quickly. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that there's a key. As Sri Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur describes in Madhurya Kadambini, all the different anarthas, all the different categories in anarthas, anarthas from past sins, anarthas from past piety, anarthas from aparad, and all of those anarthas are destroyed by chanting. So then the only anarthas you have to worry about are namaparad, offenses against chanting. And he says that all the offenses against chanting will be destroyed by being attentive. So the only thing you have to worry about is chanting attentively. That's basically it. And then making good choices when Krishna reveals to you. And what I've seen is if you don't do that, you can't continue to chant attentively. You go mad. So where does mercy fit into that? Well, how can you chant with attention unless you're given a mantra? To chant attentively implies a whole lifestyle. It's not something in isolation. In order to chant attentively, you have to be given a mantra. It means you have to have a guru. You have to be instructed by the guru how to chant attentively. So right there, that's mercy right there, isn't it? They have to do that. And in order to chant attentively, one needs to have, generally speaking, I mean, Krishna's independent. Generally speaking, 99.99999% of the time, you have to have a lifestyle that supports that. It's going to be pretty hard to chant attentively if you're playing video games. You're going to be thinking about the video game. It's going to be pretty hard to chant attentively if you're eating animals, because your consciousness will be so polluted with ignorance. You won't be able to give it your attention. It's going to be very hard to chant attentively if you're having a illicit sexual relationship. Krishna's independent, he can do whatever he wants, but you know, he can give somebody in a very unusual position the facility to chant his holy name with attention. Sometimes he does that. But generally speaking, without the guidance of a guru, chanting attentively won't be possible. You won't have the facility to control your mind. And then Krishna revealing from within the heart, that's also mercy. If you're chanting attentively, Krishna reveals himself within it from within the heart, but that's not a matter of pushing a button. Krishna's not a machine. It's not, you know, you just plug, there's Krishna. No, it's out of his own free will, because you're attracting him by your mood. If you're you know, able mechanically to focus your mind because you were yogi in your past life or something like that, or you've learned some secrets of going into a trance, and mechanically you can focus your mind, but there's no mood of affection, Krishna's not going to show up and reveal anything to you. Or not much. Or he won't reveal to you how to advance. So that's also mercy. Then when Krishna reveals to you, you have to make a choice. But the ability to give up your anarchist is also mercy. It's just like, if you, let's say that you have some disease and some friend of yours comes to you, but you just think it's normal. You're not noticing anything. Some friend comes to you and says, you know, you look a little funny. I think there might be something wrong. You know, I'm noticing there's a funny growth behind your ear. And you know, it doesn't look right. That's like the guru comes to you and says, you're in Maya. And you didn't notice it. It was behind your ear, and somehow you just never noticed it. You're, oh, really? I have a growth behind my ear? Then you start getting a little concerned. Then you go to the doctor. So you have to feel concerned. If you just say, oh, this person is just criticizing. The mercy is someone comes to you and says, there's something wrong. That's mercy. But then you have to be concerned enough to go to the doctor. And the doctor needs to see you. It's also mercy. The doctor might say, sorry, I don't have any appointments for the next 10 years, or I'm not taking any new patients. It's not just money. The doctor has to agree to see you. That's mercy. Then the doctor says, yes, this growth is cancer. It's going to kill you. You need to take it out. That's mercy. Then you have to say, okay. The doctor is not going to go into your house at midnight, anesthetize you against your will, and take out the growth. Right? Any doctor going to do that? No. You have to submit yourself. You have to go to the surgeon and say, okay, I'll come. And if you say to the doctor, will it hurt it when you take it out? Just like, look, we're just going to take it out, okay? If a good doctor is going to do with the least amount of pain possible. And then the doctor will give you, you know, advice for recovery, and you have to follow it. So there's an interplay, there's a dance, you could say, between what you do and the mercy from the experts. So guru comes, internal guru, external guru comes and says, you're in Maya, you're suffering. You're going to die, you're experiencing spiritual death. Just this morning listening to Prabhupada saying, killing the soul. You can't kill the soul, of course, but... You're killing yourself. You're dying. Hey, I think you got cancer there. Oh, really? No? Is this really cancer? Yes, it's really cancer. Okay, what do I have to do? We have to remove it. Okay, remove it. So the guru tells us we're in Maya. What do we have to do? We have to chant. As we chant, then we start seeing, oh, this service I'm doing that I thought was motivated by compassion is actually motivated by greed. It's actually lust, it's actually this, it's actually that, this isn't an ornament hanging from my ear, it's actually a tumor. So when you become aware that it's a tumor instead of an ornament, Krishna makes you aware. Does Krishna do this when we chant attentively? Does he make us aware?
Yes.
Do we have this experience? Krishna makes us aware. You're actually greedy, you're actually lust, you're actually this, actually that. So then what do? We just wear a hat? What do? Then we say, please take this out. Please get rid of it. And then he does. We can't take it out. We can't remove the anarchist. So without mercy, it's impossible. Impossible. And without our endeavor, it's not going to happen either. Without our free will. We have that free will. If Krishna took us back to Godhead without our wanting to go there, we would have stayed there. That make sense? Like, we don't have someone stay in the temple against their will. They'll just leave. Aren't they? You still want to love Krishna. You can say, well, wouldn't everybody want to love Krishna? Well, yeah, but not everybody does. I gave this example the other day. Why do people smoke? Wouldn't everybody want to be healthy? Why would anybody want to be sick? But people do. Okay, so you also have to want. You can say having healthy lungs is a higher taste than having cancer lungs and emphysema. But still, people want. But people are thinking is I'll get the benefits of smoking, which I can't think of one. But I won't get emphysema and cancer.
Better
long-term
memory.
So we're thinking I'll get some benefit out of being in touch with the material energy, but I'll make sure I won't suffer. But there's not even any benefit. So is that okay? Okay. Any other question on today's summary? Or something else?
On the same point, Srila Prabhupada said, first you have a strong faith.
Yes.
And then follow every principles and follow.
Yes. Well, in the beginning, generally the faith is not strong. Generally, faith is not strong in the beginning, and by practice and association, it becomes strong. Okay, anything else? Okay, so I don't think I'm scheduled to give class tomorrow, so I have all these notes from the textbooks for Krishna Mata. So I don't think I'm giving class tomorrow, but I should probably check with Aniruddha Prabhu. We are doing tonight from 7:30 to 8:30, Krishna willing, a multimedia virtual tour of Radhakund and Chandrakund in the theater. So much interesting. It's a lot of fun. And even those of you who've been to Radhakund and Chandrakund, you probably haven't been to all the places that we'll take you to on a multimedia tour. Okay. Well, I'm finally actually ending at 8:30. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Hare Krishna, Mataji.
Melbourne Vaishnavas, please.